This week, 70 vehicles crashed within seconds of each other near Ames during a snowstorm. This hour, the work of investigating a pileup. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also in our quick conversations to end the week this hour, IPR's Joyce Russell with a legislative update, IPR's Katarina Sestarek with the manslaughter verdict in Iowa's first Stand Your Ground case, forecasting flu outbreaks with smart thermometers, why Procter & Gamble is shedding 500 jobs in Iowa City, and in a new segment, we groove into the weekend with Tony Daner and Mark Simmon. Your news buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Ending the week the way we started it, with snow and hazardous driving conditions in parts of the state. You heard about that massive pileup near Ames on Monday, I'm sure. Some 70 vehicles crashing in a chain reaction in a matter of a few seconds. Well, coming up in just a few minutes, I'll talk with an accident reconstructor with the Iowa State Patrol about investigating such a huge pileup. But first, let's get a legislative update from Joyce Russell, IPR State House correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
So let's run through a number of things. Very busy at the State House, as we've had in the last few weeks. Can we start with education? A bitter debate over K-12 education funding.
This has been very hotly contested the last several years. This is basic state aid to public school districts, and this is per pupil funding. So they're going to increase the per pupil funding by 1% next year. That's about $67 per student. And, in the past, 4% raises were not uncommon. For the last several years, the raises have been below the rate of inflation. And so there's been a lot of outcry from schools and from the advocates for school districts about this. When you get a 1% raise, especially if you have declining enrollment, that per pupil funding, if it's only 1%, it really puts a bind on school budgets. But they haven't given final approval to this. They've added some other. The Senate added some other things to the bill, so it didn't get final approval. But they. So they have to come to an agreement on the other things that they added to the bill, but they are set on that 1%, and the governor is expected to sign it.
Here's a bill dealt with at the legislature that I haven't heard of concerning skill games for non-cash prizes. I guess these are sort of games that you might see at a county fair or something.
No, not a county fair, more like arcade games. And under Iowa law, there are two different kinds of games that can be, set up in retail establishments, and then you compete in these games, but you don't get cash back for them. You get coupons for additional merchandise or something like that, and so you can find these. They're games that you can find in bars, and they have a very small payback that you get. But then there's something called concession games, and that's at like a Chuck E. Cheese's or a Fun City. And the prize limit on that is $100. So you get $100 in coupons or maybe some small gifts. But there's an arcade restaurant establishment called Dave and Buster's. There's one in Omaha. I think there's others in surrounding states. And they kind of up the game on this, and you can win like iPads and PlayStations.
Right. So this is a bill that would raise the limit of those from $100 upwards, right?
Right, up to $950, so that Dave and Buster's can move into the state. That's what that's about.
Okay. You've been reporting this week on what has been called the fetal heartbeat legislation. That is advancing in the Senate.
It passed a subcommittee in the Senate, and it is scheduled for a Senate committee meeting this week. That means that there's a good chance that it will survive the funnel this next week. This is that would, in many people's estimation, pretty much outlaw abortion. If after the heartbeat is detected, an abortion cannot be performed, and that's generally, in many instances, before a woman may even know that she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, last year they passed a constitutionally suspect bill to limit abortions after 20 weeks. And that bill is tied up in the courts. That bill is before the Iowa Supreme Court. This bill, of course, goes much further.
And would suffer or would meet a similar sort of court challenge?
Yes, certainly it would. And that was the interesting thing that happened on that bill this week. A reliable abortion opponent, the Iowa Catholic Conference, did not register in support of this fetal heartbeat bill. And the argument that they gave is that they felt that if this became law and this went before the Iowa Supreme Court, that it could actually put other abortion restrictions in jeopardy. And so they're sort of taking, the Catholic Conference is sort of taking the long view. Mm-hmm. I think it took the abortion opponents in the legislature by surprise. And in fact, there was some backlash against the Catholic Conference for registering neutral on this bill. So that was a very interesting development.
Let's talk about the budget. Does it look like they're headed for this $52 million plan that the Senate has recommended?
No, that's getting scaled back. You're talking about the work that they're trying to get done because this fiscal year, you know, ends in June, and they're having to go in and cut this year's budget. 5 months left in the fiscal year, and they're having to cut the budget. The Senate did scale their proposal back, so it's much more in line with what the House and the governor had recommended. One striking difference is they still would take $14 million out of the regents' budgets. The governor had recommended 5, the House recommended 8, mm-hmm. and the Senate scaled theirs back from 19 to 14. That's still a pretty good hit at the regents and
higher education in Iowa.
Similarly, not as bad for the community colleges. But this has, you know, the House and Senate have to work this out. They're so close to the governor, what the governor's doing, that except for the regents, that the governor will probably sign whatever they come up to. But now the House and Senate have to agree.
Mm-hmm. I understand Funnel Week is coming up. This is where a lot of bills get eliminated. Tell us, what may not make it?
Well, it probably makes more sense to talk about what probably will make it, because there's so many bills out there, you know, mm-hmm. hundreds of bills die in the funnel. Anything that's a priority for the caucus, for the Republican majority, always gets through. So, you know, the House Republicans, for example, have initiatives out there to address the opioid epidemic, to deal with school transportation. Those are their priorities. Those will get through. Everybody's been talking earlier about tax reform, tax bills. They're not subject to the funnels. Those are ways and means bills, so they can take as long as they want to on that. Now, as for some of the other more minor bills that we have talked about, some of these have already passed the funnel. They've already passed a committee in one chamber or the other. The bill to increase marijuana or decrease marijuana penalties, that mm-hmm. has already passed a committee. The bill that I reported on about guns on school property, to let if you're a gun owner, you have a permit to carry a weapon and you tend to go about your day armed, you're called to the school to pick up a student. Under current law, it's a felony to drive onto the school property with a gun, and so they would make some exceptions for that. That has passed out of committee. And then other bills that we have talked about, the fetal heartbeat bill, is scheduled for committee action this week. And so that's okay. Usually a good sign that it's going to make it.
Okay, Joyce, thanks for the update. Look forward to talking with you on Monday for Legislative Mondays. We'll be concentrating then on a proposal for a legal needle exchange program in the state. Thanks, Joyce. Until then.
Okay, thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, challenging travel weather. That's the news of this week, especially at the start of the week and now at the end of this week. It's been a weather week that's resulted in numerous road crashes, deaths, and injuries in the state. On Monday, 8 people died due to weather-related traffic accidents. A 9th person died Tuesday evening. Now, 2 of those deaths were part of massive pileups. There was a 50 to 70 vehicle pileup near Ames and a 19 vehicle pileup that was on I-80 near Grinnell. When pileups like this occur, the events that led to this chain reaction of crashes has to be investigated and then explained. Joining us, Sergeant Chris Starrett. He is with the Iowa State Patrol. He's an accident reconstruction coordinator. Sergeant Starrett, welcome to our program.
It's nice being here. Thank you.
I understand you weren't at the biggest pileup on Monday, but you have, in your 12 years with the Iowa State Patrol, seen many like it. What can you tell us about the pileups that happened this week so far, the ones I just mentioned?
To be downright honest with you, they could all have been prevented.
How so?
Slowing down, preventing the collisions by being careful, slowing down, and not having to be distracted, should we say, on other things, looking at other things. And the conditions that took place, unfortunately, on Monday and Tuesday, of course, had blowing snow, covered roads, and just bad weather in general.
Mm-hmm.
But if we could have all just slowed down a little bit, all of it could have been prevented. And that's coming directly from the troopers that were involved with these collisions.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the most common cause is you, as a driver, enough drivers in a certain stretch just do not recognize visibility is low, you're not able to stop very quickly, and you just do not accommodate the weather with your driving speed, right?
That is correct. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. How often do pileups like this happen?
Surprisingly, not very often. Not to that substantial amount of cars.
Mm-hmm.
On a normal circumstance every year, we have at least one or two out of District 1 that include, you know, the 3 or 4 car pileup. But as for having 70 cars involved in a collision, that's a once-in-a-lifetime officer's worst nightmare, should we say.
Right. I imagine it must be. And this is usually connected when you have pileups of whatever size. It has to be seasonal, or we've had late snowfalls this year in Iowa. It has to do with the first significant snowfalls or ice storms or whatever, right?
That is correct. On what I was informed, that this was the largest snowfall that we've had since 2015, and unfortunately, people just forget on what these conditions entail.
Mm-hmm. It's a real nightmare for those involved, also for those in your team who have to reconstruct what's happened, and the first responders, of course. Take us quickly through the process of how you, as a reconstruction coordinator, work at the Iowa State Patrol when something like this happens.
Oh, when a collision like this occurs, regardless if it's the 4 cars, 3 cars, or the 70 cars, you always have to start at the beginning and work your way back. And what I mean by that is you have to start with the beginning source, the beginning collision, and then just start. Unfortunately, we have to take pictures of everything. And then given the circumstances of the weather, the road conditions and stuff like that, we would probably end up taking measurements with our total stations that we have, and take measurements of all the evidence, all the vehicles that were involved, and then, of course, collecting all of the witness statements that were involved, and then unfortunately putting the puzzle back together on how or when it all occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the collision that took place up in Ames, that one was actually, as you guys are well aware of, videotaped.
Mm-hmm.
And we can use that as evidence showing what occurred at that time and how it occurred. Given the circumstances at the Malcolm one, unfortunately, that one, is what I'm aware of, didn't show what it did up there in Ames. Right. So they have to just put the pieces back together.
Right, that big one up near Ames, I saw it on the Weather Channel. They were playing it, and the headline was 70 cars in 14 seconds. And that was on the video. So you have a video that makes it a lot easier than it does without, and in former years when there were not all these video cameras on our interstates. If it's not there, how do you determine what happened, especially when it's inclement weather, there's snow, perhaps snow covering up tracks or evidence of what happened?
Oh, yeah. That's the hardest part, is trying to collect all the evidence. But a lot of these vehicles, when they're involved in a collision, there's sometimes paint transfer, which we call contact damage. And we try to put the paint back together, should we say, mm-hmm. with the vehicles that it belongs to. And hopefully good witness statements. One of the unfortunate thing is we had officers going up to this collision up there in Ames, and the troopers, should I say, actually caught the majority of the collision actually on their cams going up there. So we take all that plus the photos that we've taken, and we put it all together, and we come up with a conclusion of what occurred, how it occurred, mm-hmm. and timing.
Do you have
and speeds, possibly.
Do you have any idea? It's hard to imagine how many man hours go into such an investigation after a mammoth pileup like this.
Well, I could tell you this, sir, is that this year, the average case, the technical collision investigation case, the average was 43 hours it takes for one collision. Now, given this substantial amount of vehicles and evidence and everything like that, you're looking at possibly over 100 hours of manpower on the trooper just to come up with a conclusion on what occurred and how.
Mm-hmm. And then you've got a whole team of other people add up their hours as well, helping out here. How do you approach such a scene? You said troopers were on the scene and could even film it happening in this case. How do you approach a scene? Because you have, you know, what are your priorities? You have people in states of shock. You have injuries. You have possible deaths. What are you thinking?
Yes.
What are you prioritizing when you go into such a scene?
Well, the initial trooper that was there with the Story County deputy, Trooper Hove, did a phenomenal job. His number one concern was, of course, everybody's safety. And when it came to that, he started from the front where it all began and started going car to car to making sure everybody was fine or if they needed medical attention. And at that point, he contacted EMS and had EMS en route on how many ambulances that were needed, how many fire trucks to extricate people out of. That's our number one goal our number one thing to do is making sure that the motoring public is safe. And if they're involved in a collision, is to get medical care to them as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. Once we have that done, then we can go into the investigation portion of it. But our number one goal is to make sure everybody is getting the medical care or the care that they need at that point, not just including the medical, but also, like you were stating, the hysteria, should we say, the emotions and stuff like that. We have to care for them. So if we can find them something warm, a place to warm to be able to collect their thoughts and then maybe get that witness statement or just talk to somebody, that's what we need to do.
Right.
And that's what we do.
One specific question, and looking at this video here, it's just breathtaking when you look at it because there are people who have crashed and then several seconds pass and then there's someone else, another car or even a semi barreling into this. What kind of advice, or is there any advice for whether if this happens to you, whether you stay in your car or you try to get out and just run as far away as you can?
Well, we will always say this, and that is to stay in the vehicle at all times. And the reasoning for it is the way the cars are developed today, you're more safe in that car because the cars are developed to crush around you instead of go through you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is going to be the safest spot. Now, I can tell you this, the collision that took place over by Malcolm, there is a trooper over there, Trooper Matt Schwinn, that ran for, because he was checking on people, he ran for his life because of another semi coming, and there was a guy that was outside, and he was trying to tell him to get out of the road, and he nearly got killed by that semi that lost it and went into the ditch, and we would have never had to worry about the trooper being out or that gentleman that almost got killed if he would have just stayed in his truck.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's what we say. I understand that people want to get out and care for other people, but in the circumstances with the weather, the roadways, and everything like that, our best suggestion is you stay in your cars and let us, unfortunately, right, let us be the ones that take the responsibility.
You're dealing with traumatized people in such situations, also families that have just been shattered by deaths, by injuries. How do you and your team of reconstructionists, I guess I'll just say accident reconstructors, cope with the emotional toll of being a first responder?
Well, we have state help if we need it. The best thing that I can say is that we talk to our loved ones, our friends, after it's all said and done.
Mm-hmm.
We're trained, very well trained, to take care of the job. Our academy trains us. The Department of Public Safety trains us to get the job done and then cope with the disaster that just took place afterwards.
Yeah, there still have to be images that are just hard to erase or deal with.
Oh, absolutely. From my experience, some of my crashes that I've had to deal with. Of course, they're still there. They're still burned into my head. But we have to use that to keep proceeding and to keep, to try to better the public, try to better our cases, try to better our safety for the future.
Mm-hmm. Sergeant Chris Starrett, I want to thank you very much for the important work that you and your team, the Iowa State Patrol, do, in especially in such situations. Thank you for this conversation, and please leave us, because we have inclement weather at the end of this week too, for a message to drivers, perhaps driving right now in snowy conditions.
The message I can give out is slow down. Getting there 5 minutes early is better than, unfortunately, not getting there at all. And so slow down, pay attention, and don't follow too close.
Okay. Sergeant Chris Starrett, Accident Reconstruction Coordinator with the Iowa State Patrol. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, IPR's Katerina Sestarek with the manslaughter verdict in Iowa's first Stand Your Ground case, forecasting flu outbreaks with smart thermometers, why Procter & Gamble is shedding 500 jobs in Iowa City, and in a new regular segment, we'll groove into the weekend with Tony Daner and Mark Simmons. The News Buzz continues after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It happened in late August of 2017. Lamar Wilson fired 5 bullets on Iowa City's crowded pedestrian mall. It was a half hour before bars closed on that late night. The shots killed 22-year-old Kalik Jones and injured two others, Xavier and Dondre Hicks. In court, his lawyers claimed self-defense for the shooting. Let's talk with IPR's Katerina Sestarek about this week's verdict in this first test case of Iowa's new Stand Your Ground law. Katerina, welcome.
Hi, Ben.
So what did the jury find this week?
So the jury found Lamar Wilson guilty of voluntary manslaughter. And that's interesting because it was a lesser charge than what he was originally charged with, which was first-degree murder. And so voluntary manslaughter, the difference there is that the jury basically found that Wilson intentionally shot the man who died, but that he did that because of a sudden, violent, and irresistible passion resulting from serious provocation. So that's quoted from the jury instructions. So basically, they found that while he did kill this man, is what the jury found, he did it because he was sort of provoked and not because he was planning this ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. The verdict also included two other counts, right?
Right. So those were two counts of assault with intent to inflict serious injury, and those were also lesser charges than the attempted murder charges that he was originally charged with.
All right. Prosecutors originally charging Wilson with one count of first-degree murder, two counts of attempted murder. Okay, Stand Your Ground. This is Iowa's new law. Remind us what Stand Your Ground in self-defense means in our new law.
So what that law does, it means a person who feels threatened has no duty to retreat before using deadly force for self-defense. So if someone has a licensed gun, which in this case, Lamar Wilson was licensed to carry weapons, a person with a licensed gun can use deadly force if they believe they're facing imminent death or serious injury, even if there's a way for them to escape. And so you can also find a homicide to be justified even if the shooter turns out to be wrong about what level of danger that person was in.
Right. So these can be real threats or just perceived threats by a reasonable person as seen. So how did that come out here? How did that defense work for Lamar Wilson?
Well, so this isn't over yet. The judge in this case, originally Wilson's lawyers wanted Wilson to be immune from prosecution even under this new law. The judge disagreed, and he said he would make a decision after the jury returns a verdict. So at this point, the judge is still waiting to schedule a hearing back in Johnson County to decide on this immunity claim. And he will actually be using a lower burden of proof than the jury did in finding their verdict. So this is not over yet.
Mm-hmm. So when we think of possible outcomes, the verdict that this jury reached could be sort of mitigated or completely erased.
Right, yes. So the judge could, if the judge were to find that Wilson was justified in the shooting, then I think he would just be let go. That's mm-hmm. what I think would happen. But yeah, mm-hmm. it remains to be seen because it is the first case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So what does this case possibly have to say about any future Stand Your Ground claims in Iowa courts? Anything?
Well, this is sort of setting the stage for the process of using a Stand Your Ground claim. The law was not specific in how a person would actually use this law, how when you're going through the court process, how this law is applied. And so this is sort of setting a precedent for how it'll be applied in Iowa. And lawyers believe that it'll go up to the Iowa Supreme Court before it's actually decided.
Okay, thank you very much. IPR reporter Katerina Sestarek reporting on the manslaughter verdict in the, calling the first test case of Iowa's new Stand Your Ground law. Thank you, Katerina.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Coming up on Monday on this program, our Legislative Monday Day, we'll look at the possible needle exchange program that's being considered at the Iowa legislature. Of course, we have the nation's opioid epidemic, and with that, injection drug use on the rise across the country and here in Iowa, and that's meant an increase in HIV and hepatitis C infections. We'll hear about efforts at the legislature to perhaps introduce a needle exchange program in the Iowa to lessen that. Well, keeping with health news, it's been a bad season for flu. We know that influenza has been widespread across the country. Tens of deaths attributed to influenza just here in Iowa. Well, now researchers at the University of Iowa are testing a new smart technology approach to tracking flu activity in real time. This is good both for the wider population and for individual levels. Let's hear about it from Aaron Miller. He's a University of Iowa postdoctoral scholar in computer science, also lead author of a work published this week in the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases. He worked together on this with the senior study author, Dr. Philip Polgreen, University of Iowa Associate Professor of Internal Medicine and Epidemiology. Aaron Miller, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben.
Tell us, you're working, first of all, before we get to the study, you're working with smart thermometers. Just to make sure, what are they?
Yeah, so these are essentially, there's two different types of thermometers. There's an ear thermometer, and it connects to a cell phone via Bluetooth. There's also what's known as a smart stick thermometer, and it sort of resembles what a typical thermometer looks like, except it connects to a headphone jack and a smartphone, and that allows you to take oral, underarm, and rectal temperatures.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so these smart thermometers out there in a certain population, what did you do?
Yeah, so what's unique about the thermometers is they actually pair to an application on a mobile device that allows you to sort of sync readings and collect readings over time. From a user's perspective, it allows you to sort of monitor the progression of a disease or sort of track the history within your family of different device users that might have had a fever or experienced different symptoms. And so what we were able to do is essentially take the anonymized data, and we're getting readings from all 50 states. We're looking at about 8 million different readings from about 450,000 different devices. And what we used is we sort of aggregated the anonymized fever readings and just used it to sort of track influenza activity across the United States just by looking at not only fevers that were being recorded by the devices, but actually just activity in the device alone, so the number of users that were taking just measurements of temperature.
Mm-hmm. And I understand your University of Iowa team compared the data you got from these smart thermometers to data gathered by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Yeah, so the CDC each week releases an ILI estimate from outpatient clinic visits, and the numbers that get released by the CDC are actually delayed by about a week or two. It takes a little bit of time to aggregate the results, and so what we did is we took the measurements that we were getting in real time and then compared them to what the CDC estimates were once they were actually released. We did this at a national level. We also did it at a regional level. And then we did it for specific age groups. So the thermometers actually allow users the option of inputting their age. And so we were able to take those ages and look at flu activity in different age groups.
Mm-hmm. So talk about the implications. As I mentioned at the start, this is good to study the wider population, how flu spreads in a population and for individuals. Let's talk about, the possibilities of this type of developing these type of technologies and data tracking for forecasting the spread of flu throughout the country? Is that where we're headed?
Yeah, so what we did is we sort of just looked at using these readings because they do come in and we have access to them about 2 weeks before information released by the CDC. We used it to just sort of create what we call a nowcast, which is just an estimate of what flu activity is at the current period. We also, in the paper, looked at building forecasts for up to 3 weeks in advance. And so given the two-week lag in CDC reporting, that works out to be somewhere in the neighborhood of about 5 weeks, quicker than what surveillance estimates would be. And the nice thing about the devices is that because we have more granular data on both user demographics as well as potentially location, we can actually create some forecasts that are at a much more granular level than a lot of the data.
So I'm trying to, when you say forecast, of course, I think of weather, especially at a time of year like this. So when we look at how this might be applied in the future, could it be similar to weather forecasting where you hear something like a storm of flu spreading to your area? So you should stay home, don't go to school, don't go to work, or get a flu shot?
Yeah, yeah. So actually, the CDC in the past, and they currently do, they've sponsored some competitions to predict and forecast what the flu activity will be down the road. And in the past, participants have used things like social media data, searching on the internet, search volume to sort of generate forecasts of where flu activity will be in a few weeks. And what's nice about this and using this data source is that we're actually measuring an actual symptom. And so we think we can generate forecasts that will be a little bit better than even using social media interest just because we're getting a clinical symptom.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, what's nice about having a device that actually has user input from users is that we actually have the potential to create a feedback loop where we can actually implement public health interventions through the device. So you could imagine sending out alerts to users once we detect or forecast high activity in a given region. We could sort of prompt users and say, it looks like flu is about to peak in your area. Have you gotten a flu shot yet? So we think there's some potential public health interventions that we could use the device for as well.
Wow, that's fascinating work. Aaron Miller, lots more to talk about. Connect with your work. That's all the time we have right now. Aaron Miller, University of Iowa postdoctoral scholar in computer science, talking about the use of some new smart technology, smart thermometers to track flu activity in real time. Aaron Miller, thanks for sharing your research with us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, bad news for Iowa announced this week by the employer Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble is shifting production to a giant new factory in West Virginia as well as Cincinnati. It will result in cutbacks in operations and, among other places, in Iowa City. Also, it's going to close its Kansas City factory, but focusing on Iowa City, the changes will be completed in 2020. Affecting 500 workers in Iowa City, about 700 workers remaining in Iowa City, where P&G operates two factories. Try to understand the forces driving this move by P&G by talking with Dave Swenson, associate scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. Hi again, Dave.
Hello.
P&G says it's going to move production of its hair care and body washes out of Iowa City by late 2020. Those products will be made in a new plant in West Virginia. The oral care products, I think this is toothbrushes and so forth, made in Iowa City, not to be part of these shifts. What can you tell us about why P&G would make this move? What's their point of view here?
Well, their point of view is this is part of a long-term study that they had begun earlier this decade, where they were trying to assess their entire distribution and production operations, and they came up with a solution, and their solution was to consolidate production at a centralized facility that probably minimized the distance that the goods would have to travel to their customers. And what made sense to them, from what I can read, is that they wanted to be much closer to their East Coast customer base. If you think about this, shampoo, cosmetics, those types of things, they're heavy. And so you want to minimize your production costs. You want to minimize your transportation costs. And one of the ways to do that is to find a place that's centrally located within your dominant customer base. And that's what it looks like they're doing. It's also, they are consolidating many lines, several lines at this one factory in West Virginia, as well as they're going to have suppliers right there in that facility as well. So there seems to be a lot of efficiencies that they're seeking.
Okay, so this is not one of those stories where we say international trade exporting jobs to a different country. This is intra-country.
It is. It's intra-country, and it's not also some of the conventional interstate dynamics that we have where Procter & Gamble was, playing one state off the other. They indeed were playing states off one another out east or in the eastern part of the Midwest when this was first set up. But this has been part of what appears to be a corporate plan that was well understood by people in the economic development field. So it's not like they're raiding us. It's just a simple straightforward shifting of operations to another place seeking efficiencies.
Okay, let's go from the macro to the micro picture. The local economy in Johnson County where this takes place here, the move means 500 P&G employees. I think it's about 40% of the company's total employment in Iowa City will see their jobs cut over the next couple of years. Now, P&G, of course, pledging to work with local workers to transition to possibly in the company or another employer. What can you say about how this move will impact the local economy in Johnson County? I mean, Johnson County has very low unemployment, right?
Well, it does, and that's because it's a university town, and they just characteristically have low unemployment. Johnson County has two things going for it. One, it's a metropolitan area, and then two, it's the fastest growing metro over the last decade, and so it's got a good, strong, healthy economy. But this is going to leave a mark. That initial 500 jobs, we have a multiplier effect. I can run those 500 jobs through my input-output model of the Johnson County economy, and after everything works its way through the economy, after all of these losses are realized, it could multiply through to as many as 1,140 total jobs lost, because you lose the jobs at the factory, you lose jobs from the suppliers and the distributors, and then you lose the jobs that are supported by the workers and the suppliers spending their incomes in the regional economy. And that would amount to almost $71 million worth of labor income lost to the region.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, so it's where these people who work at P&G, where they go to lunch, you know, that might be a deli or a restaurant that has a hard time in the coming years.
Well, it is, and then it's just everything that a household buys. And it's part of it. That's the localized impact, but the broader impact works its way through the entire economy, lower spending for all goods and services within the Johnson County economy. So it's going to have a darn big impact in that economy, and it won't be ignored. But again, back what I was saying, that has been the healthiest economy in Iowa, and I would think that the Johnson County economy can recover quite well from it, unlike some of our other counties that don't have the diversification and the resiliency that the Johnson County economy has.
Okay, thank you. Dave Swenson, associate scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University, talking about news this week of hundreds of workers in Iowa City losing their jobs over the next couple of years at Procter & Gamble as the employer shifts production out of state. Dave Swenson, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And finally, to end this News Buzz edition of River to River, what we hope will be a regular News Buzz segment, Groove into the Weekend is what we've titled it. We're here to do just that. Groove into the Weekend by sampling some music and learning about some live music events coming up in the area. Joining me to do that, Tony Daner and Mark Simmet, hosts of IPR's Studio One program Gas Money, which features local and regional artists. Tony and Mark, hi.
Hey, Ben.
Hello, Ben.
Wonderful to join you on this little impromptu opening to what we hope will be a regular feature here. Let's quickly get to it. We've got a little bit of music to play, but first of all, we heard about the lineup for the Hinterland Music Festival this summer. Tell us something about that.
Yeah, the big announcement was made this past week, just a few days ago, and always a great lineup at the Hinterland Festival. Only been around, I think this is the fourth annual one coming up in 2018. But a very impressive organization there, logistically and musically. It's a great weekend of music. Sturgill Simpson, one of the headliners, put into the category of country musician, but he does so much more than just simply what you think of as country music. And Band of Horses, the other headliner, Churches, Nathaniel Rateliff, and the Night Sweats, Margo Price, other bands, and a couple of Iowa bands on the bill. The Nadas and Ancient Posse, nice contrast there. The Nadas are celebrating 25 years as a band, and Ancient Posse, one of the up-and-coming bands right now. So you get both ends of the spectrum. Should be a great weekend.
Okay. Also coming up this weekend, Saturday night in Waterloo, Friends of KUNI, Blues Blowout. I can't do my Bob Dorr impersonation. Okay, I will try. Hey, rock and roll babies. Okay, no. Okay, go ahead. Tell us about the Blues Blowout. That was bad.
No, it wasn't too bad.
It's like he's here with us.
Yeah, he is here in spirit, no doubt. And in reality, he's somewhere. Blues Blowout this weekend. Sonny Landreth is the headliner for that. Louisiana musician, over 40 years playing his music. Very distinctive slide guitar style of Sonny Landreth. There aren't many guitarists where you hear a couple of notes and you know who they are, and he is one of those people. He's going to be the headliner. Also, speaking of Bob Dorr, one of Bob's bands will be there, Blue Mississippi, and also the band Mississippi Heat on the bill. That's at the Electric Park Ballroom in Waterloo. Friends of KUNI is the name of the organization that puts this on every year. And it's always another great musical event that we look forward to, and that's Saturday night. Music starts at 6. Tickets still available. Check it out at iowapublicradio.org.
Okay, last mentions before we rock out, groove into the weekend with the Nadas from their new album, One Louder. Last things to mention on our music scene?
Yeah, letting you know, Fat Tuesday is coming up. You know, we had a event at the Des Moines Social Club last Friday. This was a Mardi Gras pre-party, if you want to call it that, kind of sponsored by IPR, the Des Moines Social Club, Civic Music Association. NOLA Jazz Band and Grand Avenue Ruckus were both there. NOLA Jazz Band, part of the Iowa Jazz Hall of Fame, Grand Avenue Ruckus, kind of a big rowdy brass band. We had our recording crew of Phil Moss and Chris Fenton there to record both of the bands, and we'll be hearing snippets of their performances on Studio One Tracks, our nightly music show, coming up Sunday through Tuesday this week. And also be sure to tune in for Gas Money Saturdays at 1 o'clock on your favorite Iowa Public Radio frequency. Great regional music. And we're going to be hearing a live set from Des Moines' The Soul Searchers tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock.
Tony Daner, Mark Simmet, thanks so much. Let's go out with a little bit of the Nadas' Best Weekend Ever, the title of this track from their new album, One Louder, just announced as part of the Hinterland Music Festival lineup this summer.
Thursday in the old hood, meet at the Greenwood. Everybody's searching for their soul.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.
Of rock and roll.